Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 91 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. As we turn the page on a difficult year for all of us, it's time to look ahead, to celebrate making it this far, and maybe to blow off a little steam. In the Middle Ages, the first of the year was the Feast of the Circumcision, or, in northern France, the Feast of Fools. The Feast of Fools is perhaps best known to us in everything from Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame to actual serious scholarship as being a time of absolute chaos and debauchery, sanctioned by the church whose clergy participated with drinking, dirty jokes, dancing, and the most sacrilegious practices. Believe it or not, though, most of our ideas of riotous clergy and the Feast of Fools are actually the result of centuries of hearsay. This week, I invited Dr. Max Harris to speak with me about the Feast of Fools. An emeritus fellow and independent scholar at the Institute for Research in the Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Max has focused much of his scholarly work on the medieval church and its festivals and celebrations. He's the author of 6 books, including Carnival and Other Christian Festivals, Folk Theology and Folk Performance, and Christ on a Donkey, Palm Sunday, Triumphant Entries, and Blasphemous Pageants. With Sacred Folly, A New History of the Feast of Fools, Max literally rewrote the book on this notorious festival, rediscovering the way in which it was actually celebrated in the Middle Ages. Here's our conversation on what we've long misunderstood about the Feast of Fools, what its place was in both theology and the Christian calendar, and how folly can be sacred. Thank you, Max, for joining me to talk about the Feast of Fools. It is that time of year when the Feast of Fools was happening around France especially, so it's great to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So you start the book out with a couple of quotations, one from the Middle Ages and one from Barbara Tuchman, which is just insane. She's talking about how there are priests and they're dressed up and there's people flinging manure and they're drinking in the church, they're singing dirty songs. It reminds me of that part in Ghostbusters where Bill Murray is saying, "What's going to happen when the ghosts are released? It's going to be mass hysteria." And that's what I'm picturing when we have this quotation about the Feast of Fools. So is that the general impression people have of this festival?
I would hope over the last 10 years that general impression has shifted some as people have read the book. But certainly when Barbara Tuchman was writing, that was the standard procedure. And if you read the footnotes in my book, you'll find a couple of places where I say, I used to believe this too, to my embarrassment. And I quote from the previous book, which was Carnival and Other Christian Festivals, where I had stuff on the Feast of Fools that was entirely wrong because I was buying into the standard assumed reading of the Feast of Fools. I thought it was a precursor of Carnival, and it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody thought it was a precursor of Carnival. So where did we get this impression that it was this crazy upside down time?
To put it very simply, I think it's the post-Enlightenment view of the Middle Ages. When you become terribly rational, you think the Middle Ages must be terribly irrational. And so you discover things in the medieval repertoire that suit your version of what it used to be. And the Feast of Fools lent itself to that because there was a failure to distinguish between what was going on in the church, such as the office of the circumcision in Sens, which is gorgeous. It's a beautiful, beautiful liturgy, dignified liturgy. That and what was inherited from the old calends, January calends, New Year festivities that went on outside the church. You confuse those two, and then you read back into the early Feast of Fools what you're discovering from, say, 16th century shenanigans going on outside the church, and assume that those all went on in the church. And then you get somebody like E.K. Chambers, his 2-volume book on medieval theatre, who documents all the claims. And I started writing this book by going through Chambers and following up all his claims. You know, believing Chambers was the place to go, he was right, he knew what was going on. And I went back and then started going back to the sources. And the more sources I read, the more I realized, no, there's something else going on here altogether. And that just took me into discovering that Feast of Fools wasn't what I thought it was. So I was along with everybody else thinking it was this drunken riot and donkeys braying and chaos going on and people burning sausages at the altar. It sounded fun. As a historian of carnival, I was sort of attracted to it, but that's not what it was. And it was something much more wonderful and much more dignified and much more impressive than that.
Yeah, it sounds like a great time. And when you find out people weren't actually sensing the church with old shoes, maybe it loses something. I don't know.
It loses something in a sense, but you can go outside the church later in history and you can find those kinds of things going on with the Société Joyeuse, the youth groups that put on activities outside the church. And what was going on inside the church was, I suspect, in large measure, an attempt on the part of the church to keep the young clerics from what was going on outside the church, because the Sens Feast of Circumcision took 24 hours. I mean, it just went on all the time. So if you were going to be in church for that, you couldn't be in the outside stuff. So, yeah, it sounds fun, but I think, given my choice, I'd have been inside, not outside. I think what was going on inside was so much more impressive and so much more profound.
Well, let's start with what's going on inside then. What's going on inside the church? It's the Feast of the Circumcision, and it becomes the Feast of Fools. What's happening inside the church during that day?
What's happening is you've got four different feasts over the Christmas season, okay, which honor different members of the clergy. So that the Feast of the Innocents, for example, which is late in December, honors the choir boys. It's the Feast of the Small Boys. And then the Feast of Fools honors the subdeacons, who are the lowest rank of the major clergy. And what you're doing is you're, for one season a year, you're overturning all conventional hierarchies. So on the Feast of Innocents, the choir boys run the show. Choir boy preaches a sermon. They're centered. On the Feast of Fools, it's the day of the subdeacons. So the subdeacons sit in the places of privilege inside the church. They lead the worship. They're privileged. So what you're doing is celebrating an inversion of hierarchy. Now, to the Enlightenment people, that looked like something terribly irrational. If you put it inside the Christian story, it's exactly what you should be doing, because what the incarnation does is completely collapse all hierarchies. Here's God, made the world, creator, runs the world, and he's becoming a little baby. I mean, it just goes to hierarchies. And you have that line in the Magnificat, which is sung at Vespers every evening. He has put down the mighty from their seat and raised up the humble and meek. And you sing that, and once a year, they actually get to act that out and recognize what happened in Christ with the nativity and the collapsing of hierarchies. And they celebrate that collapsing of hierarchies by reversing the hierarchies within the church. I think it's a lovely, lovely idea.
Yes, well, it's really based in, like, as you say, the ideas that were going around at the time, people really recognizing Christ's humanity as being a huge part of medieval worship. Yes. And when you're saying that people are inverting the hierarchies, that doesn't mean that the choir boys are going bananas inside the sanctuary, are they?
No, they just get to lead the service. I mean, in a sense, it's a sort of training exercise. These are the choir boys, some of whom are in their late teens, because they're in the choir school, who are expecting to be clergy or whatever in the future, or bishops. So to elect one of them Bishop of Fools, what he's doing is practicing for his future role. It's like youth soccer teams. You get to play soccer. It doesn't mean you all run wild on the soccer pitch. You get to play soccer as little boys, because some of you are hoping to play professional soccer later. So some of the subdeacons would have been hoping they might rise in the ranks and become important later, so they get to practice.
Yeah, they get a little look behind the screen at some of the mysteries.
That's
as
right.
They're doing this.
They get to practice, and they get to, and the Sens and the Beauvais Feast of the Fools offices are glorious. The office of the Circumcision in Sens and in Beauvais was probably longer than any other feast of the year. They were in church longer for that feast than for anything else. And it was a very dignified office.
Yes. And when we're talking about this being kind of a feast of fools, one of the things you mentioned in the book is this is not fools as in people who are creating shenanigans. What does fools mean in the medieval imagination?
In the Bible, there are two kinds of fools. There's the fool who says there is no God. And then there's the fool for Christ, who is chosen precisely because he is weak. He is not wise. He's not one of the upper class. He's not one of the powerful hierarchy. He lacks power. The feast of the Société Joyeuse, who did foolish things outside the church, they're celebrating, in a sense, the first kind of fool, except they're wanting to make fun of the fool who does immoral things or breaks society's conventions. The Feast of Fools is celebrating the other kind of fool, which involves the inversion of hierarchies, so that the person at the bottom becomes the person at the top, even if temporarily, which is exactly what the Apostle Paul said God did. That is, he chose the weak and he chose the foolish. And so the Feast of Fools celebrates the weak and the foolish by giving them a privilege. And so if you confuse those two terms, you get in an awful mess with the Feast of Fools. But if you keep the two terms apart and recognize the distinction, then the Feast of Fools inside the church makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Well, I want to get to the foolishness that's happening outside of the church. But one of the things that I want you to talk about, if possible, is the fact that there were games and there were songs and there were not quite pranks, but silly things that sometimes happen as part of religious service at the time. So that when we think of medieval church, we think of that mass, we think of it as always being solemn, when actually there were some things that we might think of now as being irreverent that were actually part of the medieval religious experience. So can you tell us about some of those things?
In Beauvais, they brought a donkey into the church. That was part of the procession, and it wasn't considered irreverent. It was part of the Feast of Fools was bringing a donkey into the church to represent, if I'm understanding it correctly, the incorporation of the Gentiles or the Jews, whichever way you read it, into the Christian church. And donkeys in church were not unusual, because when you celebrated the Feast of the Innocents, there are cases like in Pisa in Italy, where two clerics, one playing Joseph, one playing Mary, and carrying presumably a doll or a baby, are on a donkey in the church during the service, and then they're led out. So donkeys in church are not unusual. In the Ordo Prophetarum, which is when lots of people representing prophets come into the church at a particular time of the year, you have a donkey brought into the church playing Balaam's donkey. So donkeys in church are not unusual. Nowadays, we only allow donkeys in church for St. Francis Day, or in some parts of the world for St. Anthony's Day, and probably the donkey stays outside and the pet dogs and cats come inside. And we think that's a little bit odd, but okay, once a year. But those things weren't considered odd at all in the Middle Ages. They were perfectly respectable. Another example would be the ball game that I describe in the book, where you have a labyrinth inside the church built into the floor of the nave. And you have this game when the dean, I think it is, finds it. It's a one-way labyrinth. It's not a maze that you get lost in. There's just one way in and one way out. And he gradually follows the maze into the center of the maze. And the clergy circle the maze, and he's throwing a ball to them, and they throw it back as they sing this song, as they're doing this. And it's understood to be representing, because this is usually done at Easter, representing Christ's descent into hell and redeeming the people and coming back out again. And it's lovely. What we've now done is take the labyrinth and turn it into a sort of quiet meditative thing where we walk to the center and feel pious and walk back out again. And we don't have it inside the church, we have it outside. But in the medieval ages, they didn't just have a labyrinth in the church, they were able to play this fun ball game and sing a hymn while they did it.
Yeah, exactly. There isn't the same separation between what is maybe earthier, what is maybe too joyful for church. That's not how things were in the Middle Ages. And you're somebody who studied theater a lot. And one of the places where I first encountered it was in medieval pageant plays or medieval mystery plays, yes, where you have all sorts of things that you think are kind of scandalous, these racy jokes or jokes about, yes, you know, toilet humor.
Yes.
But that was really, really kind of a normal part of exploring humanity.
Yes. Peter Brook wrote a book. You know who Peter Brook is? He's a great director, theater director. He's now about 96, I think. But he wrote a book called The Empty Stage. And in it, he has a chapter on what he calls the rough and the holy. And he celebrates the fact that Shakespeare put both in there, the rough and the holy. That's what makes Shakespeare great. Shakespeare gets that from the Middle Ages. And when we discovered neoclassical rules of order in the theater, then the two were separated. So you got comedy or farce, and then you got very respectable tragedy. What you get in the Middle Ages is you've got no separation of the two. And Eric Auerbach, in his classic book Mimesis, takes that back to the Middle Ages and talks about how in the Middle Ages, the rough and the holy were not separate. He doesn't use those terms, but the rough and the holy weren't separated, but they were all part of one. And they were part of one for the very reason the biblical story itself embraces rough and holy. And the Nativity embraces rough and holy, you know, and there's some funny things happen in the Bible. And
it's true.
You know, we have this idea that the Bible should always be read in a very pious voice, and nothing funny ever happens. And Jesus never laughed. And Jesus actually was a very bad punster. I mean, he calls Peter Rocky, you know. On this rock, I'm going to call you Rocky, and on this rock, I'm going to build my church. And you think, that's a bad pun, but, you know, okay. And my favorite moment, my favorite funny moment is when the Egyptians are pursuing the Israelites across the Red Sea, okay? And the water has risen up on either side, and the Israelites have made it to the far side. Pharaoh gallops through on his chariot, and there's this lovely verse that in some translations goes something like, and their wheels dropped off. And it's what I call a Donald Duck moment. You, in Pharaoh, he's galloping across, and suddenly the wheels fall off his chariot, and he's stuck in mud, and he looks up at these waves and goes, uh-oh. And the water comes in. Or in the same time, the Egyptian magicians, you know, Moses goes, all right, I'm going to turn all the water into blood. Boom. And they go, oh, we can do that too. And they find some water he hasn't turned into blood and turn that into blood too. And you think, no, if they were smart, they'd turn the blood back into water. So it's comic, you know. You can make frogs, we can make frogs. You can make fleas, we can make fleas. And I think it's hilariously funny. You know, at least there's a comic element to it. So I think mixing the rough and the holy, or just the nativity, you know, Jesus being born in a manger with a cow and a donkey, which is how we traditionally see it. It's a refusal to separate the rough and the holy, which is exactly what the incarnation is, because what it is the holy God becoming a messy baby, you know? Yeah. He fouled his diapers. He really did, if he even had diapers. The incarnation celebrates the rough and the holy. And what Eric Auerbach says is that that's why medieval theater was the way it was. And it's the setting aside that and separating things under the classical way of doing things that gets rid of the rough and holy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think both of those things, as you say, it can be both at the same time. Like the Pharaoh's chariot losing its wheels can be comic, it can be tragic. It depends on how you play it, right? Exactly. And that's medieval theology in a nutshell.
That's right. Yep.
And I think it's worth saying that we were just talking about your latest book being Christ on a Donkey, which is not only the best title, you know, I've heard in a long time, but also it really kind of gets at the fact that these things, they go together, especially in the medieval imagination.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I do want to get at what's happening outside of the church, because you said you're drawn into this looking at Carnival and that some of the celebrations around the Calends of January are what's continuing through the Middle Ages. So what's happening outside of the church around the time of the Feast of Fools?
Okay, let me back up and I'm going to tell you how I decided to write the book, and then we'll get to what happened outside. I had written a book called Carnival and Other Christian Festivals, and I had ambitiously decided, because nobody seemed to know what the roots of carnival were. They tend to put them in Saturnalia and Bacchanalia, and I'd written an article saying there's absolutely no evidence for that at all. Carnival started later, okay? So what were the roots of carnival? And then I decided the real problem wasn't the roots of carnival worldwide, it was the roots of European carnival, because European carnival goes to Latin America and then things get drawn into it from the indigenous population. So that's a different story. So what were the European origins of carnival? Which is not to say there weren't other origins, but just looking at the European side of things. So then I thought, all right, well, I've got a 50-page article says it's not the Saturnalia and the Bacchanalia and pre-Christian rites. The January calends, actually the earliest evidence of those is after the empire became Christian. There's no record of the January calends, especially mask wearing before that. So this is not a pagan thing. So I thought, all right, well, I can see how that happened. Then the next thing surely is the Feast of Fools, because everybody says that what happened was the calends went into the church and then came back out again and flowed into carnival. So, right, I'll write the next part of this book on the Feast of Fools. And I just started digging into the records and digging into what Chambers said and digging into the standard histories of the Feast of Fools, and going back and tracing the sources, because I always want to go back to the original source. And the more I got back to the sources, the more I realized this is not the real thing. and I was sitting down over dinner at a conference on medieval theatre in Lille with a man called Bob Potter, who had been my mentor years ago when I got my MA in Santa Barbara. And we were talking about this, and I said, somebody needs to write a book on the Feast of Fools so I can write the book on Carnival. And he looked across the table at me and said, you write the book on Feast of Fools. And so I ended up dumping the Carnival book and writing the Feast of Fools book.
Oh my gosh, so many things happen like that, don't they?
Yes. And so what went on outside the church was the inheritance of the Calends of January masking tradition. Okay. They went from everything from, the sort of thing that happens in Carnival. You know, you go around, you're not begging for money, but you're frightening people into giving you funds. That's one thing. You're splashing around in water. You're forcibly baptizing clergy you capture in the font in the main square. You're driving a cart through the town and flinging cow dung at people. So the sort of wild thing that tends to go on at Carnival. And this was going on outside the church. This became more organized when you had what were called sociétés, in France, sociétés joyeuses, festive societies, who gradually began to put on plays, and the festivities became bigger and it became more orderly. And in some cases, there was a link between the two, in that the cathedral's abbot of fools or the cathedral's pope of fools would play some role in what was going on outside the church. But there was always a very clear distinction between what was going on in the church and what was going on outside the church. So what went on outside the church was people did wear masks, people did cross-dress, people did all the kinds of things that people like Chambers and Tuchman thought happened inside. But there's a very clear distinction. In most cases, they were two entirely different traditions that happened on the same day.
Well, as you were talking about this, you're saying that there were in France these societés joyeuses. Do you think that that's why this kind of idea of the Feast of Fools being this carnivalesque is associated with France because of these societies?
Yes and no. The Feast of Fools is pretty much limited, the Feast of Fools in the church sense that I mean, it is pretty much limited to northern France. There are some in southern France, but there's a map in the beginning of my book, and you can just trace all of the places where there was evidence of a Feast of Fools. And you can see it goes down across France. That's where it was. There were a couple of cases in England, but nothing elsewhere, no Feast of Fools in Germany or Italy or anywhere else. So it's a French and predominantly a northern French tradition. I only followed the Sociétés Joyeuses in France. I didn't look at them elsewhere. I'm sure there are traditions like that elsewhere too.
One of the things that you get into in the book is a tradition of having Herod, not plays, but Herod games that are happening where people are exploring King Herod as, well, in medieval plays, he tends to be this rage-filled monster, but people are exploring this in the church as ways of getting close to that theology again. And that in the book, if I have it right, you were saying that this is more a Germanic tradition, yes. The Herod game.
There are Herod games in France too, and there's the Herod game in Padua. But it is a predominantly German tradition. And what it was, you had a liturgical play of some sort. We need to remember that the word for play is both game and play, theater.
Yeah, production.
It's the same in Latin. Ludus can mean game, or it can mean what we mean by a play, a dramatic piece. So when we talk about Herod games, we may be just talking about Herod plays. So anyway, a play was put on, and the Herod plays, what they actually do is demonstrate the failure of power, the failure of arrogant, proud power. Quite appropriate at the moment, if I may say so, without being too political. This is naughty, and if you want to erase this, do it. But I would love to stage a Herod play where Herod looks like Trump.
Oh my goodness, yeah, yeah. That irrational raving is very similar, right?
That's right. So it's this irrational raging. And he's a frightening figure, but ultimately he's a fool. He's a failure. He's a loser. And that's what the Herod plays do. And they're well-constructed plays that were done in the church. There is some evidence that they would then go back after the play was done inside the church to the place wherever the clergy were having their meals, the canons were having their meals. And they might put on some extra games in that context where – the, you know, sword fights, because they've had mock swords to kill the children in the Feast of the Innocents, and where they exaggerate some of the traits, and it's fun. They may have had masks to represent the lions in the Beauvais one. So there's different things that may have gone on, but I don't think there's any evidence of riotous activities there. But there may have been some kind of games going on afterwards. But that was after the service.
Yes, that's important to mention that it's after the service. And this is around, well, this is the Feast of the Innocents, right? So this is already when the boys have a more important position. So maybe it is a way of blowing off steam after they've just done the most solemn rites that they can within the church.
That's right. And it's another way of laughing at Herod. I'm sure he didn't win any of the games.
No, probably not. And I think I'm thinking of it as a way of, well, people are always saying, you know, did medieval people love their children, that kind of thing. But the Feast of the Innocents, it's a terrible massacre that people are talking about. And so working it out through making Herod a figure of ridicule, I think, is a way of kind of coping with it and making it part of the story that is celebratory around Christmas time. Do you think that's the case?
Possibly. I hadn't thought of that, but that's certainly viable. Yes.
Good to know.
Well, officially, why the children are not in trouble is they are the first martyrs. So a lot of the Herod plays end up with the children as victorious martyrs, and Herod is the fool who gets defeated and carried off by the devils. Okay. So, and at that period in time, martyrs were very much being celebrated. So if you stage the children, the innocents, as the first martyrs for Christ, then they get this privileged position. They go directly to heaven. They stand on top of the rood screen and they sing triumphant songs. So it's within the Christian narrative of the time, the slaughtered children win and raging Herod loses. And I've not come across anything that suggests that we now need to take the poor little boys back and let them have a cup of wine each and be a bit tiddly and we'll tell them it's all right, you didn't die. but that would certainly be an appropriate human reaction.
Yeah, I didn't mean soothing the children so much, who might be thinking of it as a time where they get to have this privilege. But mostly I was thinking about soothing maybe parents who are thinking about this and maybe thinking about it in a way where you're celebrating these boys as being martyrs instead of being victims.
Yes, yeah. The mum's there. She's got, oh, look, little Pierre, he's up on the rood screen singing. He'll be lovely.
So I'm thinking about many of these games and plays and stuff being centered around the Christmas season. Yes. And we've mentioned that there's ball playing and singing and joyful stuff happening around Easter as well. Do you find that this kind of carries on throughout the Christian year, or do you think it's mostly kind of centered around these two major times especially?
I think that this time of year used to go from about December 12th through Carnival Tuesday. And that whole period was a time of celebrating hierarchical inversion, so that what happened at the Feast of Fools outdoors also continued to happen up until Mardi Gras, what we now call Mardi Gras. Okay. And then you had Lent, so it all stopped. And what happened, I think, was that as the push for more rational behavior, let's put it that way, better behavior grew, that these carnival activities got pushed up against carnival, against Mardi Gras. So they're now crowded into that. And you get some remnants of those at Christmas, but the period between is not so carnivalesque. But I think it was originally one long winter period of celebration. I mean, you couldn't go out and dig the fields at that time of the year. And you all killed a pig at that time of the year, so you had plenty to eat. it was a time of keeping warm by doing fun things before you had to go out and work outside again.
I can really get on board with that. I think that's a great idea.
But, you know, in parts of the world, they still do this. The Trinidad Carnival, which I had the privilege of being at about 10, 15 years ago now, and is the biggest carnival in the Caribbean, that starts before Christmas. The actual making of the costumes, the celebrating, the getting ready for it, it takes place. And when it finally bursts out on Carnival Monday, the day before Carnival itself, it's the accumulation of things that have been done all along. It's not just something that happens for carnival. So the most places that still observe carnival as a traditional rite start the preparations before Christmas, the carnivalesque season. And carnival is too. My own theory was that carnival was somewhat grounded in the this is why I wrote the book Carnival and Other Christian Festivals, that Carnival is grounded historically in the notion of the incarnation, in the reversal of hierarchies. It's a outdoor, it's become secular, but it's an outdoor celebration of reversal of hierarchies that is no longer celebrated as a Christian feast, but has its roots in the doctrine of the incarnation.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. If I can take that leap and say, yeah, as someone who studied this for so long, I'm pretty sure you're right about that.
Well, sure.
But I think that, yeah, that idea of really entrenching these human earthy kind of ideas into the religious is something that we definitely get from the Middle Ages, even if it kind of loses its power or maybe loses its place in society and gets kind of relegated to just one day of the year. I had a question that came up just as we're talking, and that is, you have in the book that some of the clergy are complaining about the Feast of Fools. Do you think that's because people are taking kind of shelter from the weather in the nave of the church to have their revels in there?
No, I think it's because...
Okay.
I think it's more likely to be that some of the younger clergy were going outside and joining in what was going on outside. But you've also got this attempt to control activity from above. So I quote the example of a Pope, Innocent III, I think it was, who keeps issuing diatribes against the Feast of Fools. And he obviously has no idea what's going on at all. He's just heard stories. and he gets quoted as authoritative. And then there's Jean Gerson, who also decided he was going to take on the Feast of Fools without any indication that he'd actually ever been there, that he'd ever seen one. And at one of the church councils, he got something passed suppressing the Feast of Fools, which is what the faculty in Paris pick up on in that classic sentence that gets quoted all the time about the bad things that happened to the Feast of Fools. And so there's that suppression from above. I suspect it's got nothing to do with what was actually happening, but a certain resistance against reversals of hierarchy. People at the top of hierarchies don't tend to like hierarchies being reversed. And I think there's a resistance to that. And if you can hear stories of ugly things happening on those days and you can attach them to the Feast of Fools, then you have a legitimate reason in your own mind for suppressing the Feast of Fools. What is striking in my mind is the degree of resistance that local chapters engaged in to resist those kinds of suppressions. You know, if the Feast of Fools was as bad as people make it out to be, why were these chapters year after year after year saying, no, you can have money to do it. No, you're going to do it. And finding ways around the prohibitions that were coming down from on top in order to continue to do it. It wasn't because they were into rioting and drunkenness. It was because they knew on a local level the precious thing that this feast was.
And as you say in the book, people, when they describe the Feast of Fools, they're taking bits from everywhere and conflating them as if it happened all in one place at
one time.
That's
absolutely right. Yes. Yeah. If you have an idea of the Feast of Fools as bad, you then put all the untested quotations you can, put them together and go, that happened everywhere, every Feast of Fools, always, for over four centuries. And it is so demonstrably wrong, but it has been said so often that people believed it. When I started work on this book, I basically went back to E.K. Chambers, and that's a book came out in about 1902. Two-volume book came out about 1902. Nobody had written anything challenging Chambers seriously for a long, long time. I quote a Frenchman called Aimé Chereste, who in the 19th century challenged the prevailing view. But Chambers wrote his, nobody had challenged Chambers. What was very gratifying when this book came out was how many people came to me and said, you know, I'd always thought there was something wrong with Chambers, but I didn't know what. And what I was able to do was just diligently track down what was wrong.
And yes.
There were some lovely moments. I spent a semester at Yale Divinity School as a visiting professor. And the key book that Chambers must have read everything that was available. I don't know whether he worked in the British Library or he went overseas and tracked down books overseas. I don't know, but he had read everything except a book by a man called Louvet about the feast in Beauvais. And he was quoting from somebody else to describe this early feast in Beauvais who had claimed to have read Louvet. And Chambers didn't have this, so he just assumed the later description was right. And I managed to find this book in the rare books library at Yale. And it was in the process of transition from one part to another. They dug it up for me, founded it, and I was able to hand copy, because you couldn't copy it because it would have hurt the back. So I was able to hand copy the two key pages that Chambers didn't have. And it completely transforms the view of what happened in Beauvais. That was exciting. But it was a matter of simply tracking down the sources that Chambers claimed to have used. And he was thorough, but nobody had done anything since Chambers. But a lot of people had obviously felt that there has to be something else going on besides that, because that doesn't make sense, but they didn't know what.
Yeah.
It was just a question of digging in the records.
Well, it was jaw-dropping for me, some parts in the book where he's translated things like the people kind of ran excitedly out of the house, and he's translated as the people ran violently out of the church.
Yes.
That's a big difference.
Yes. Once you've got in your head that something was so, you read the evidence to conform to the image you've got in your head. I was just blessed in that I went in with this image in my head and read enough that it became clear that the image was incorrect. And then I just started digging more. But if you just come to it, Chambers clearly came to it with this image and found that's what he kept finding.
Yeah, well, the moral of the story is a lot of people come to the Middle Ages, even great scholars come to the Middle Ages with certain expectations, and you can't read the evidence that way. You have to read it in a way that is open enough that you realize that things might not be the way you thought.
You have to go back to the original text. You can't go for secondhand texts, because secondhand texts have an agenda. You have to go back to the original record. You can also question the agenda of the original record, but you have to go back to the original records. You can't take any scholarly verdict, even mine. You have to go back to the original records. And that's what it did. That's what I was able to do over a period of about, I don't know, it took me about 10 years to write that thing.
Well, it's a great book. And I really appreciate the work that you put into it, because I think that that is something that needs to be changed, this impression of this completely debauched Middle Ages based around the Feast of Fools. So thanks so much, Max, for coming on the show to talk to us about it.
You're welcome. It's been fun. I'm glad to be part of it.
Thanks. To find out more about Max's work, you can check out his bio at the Institute for Research in the Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison at irh.wisc.edu/staff/harris-max. Or you can find him on academia.edu at wisc.academia.edu/Max Harris. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Over the last few days, we've posted a couple pieces from Steve Mulberger talking about jousting and tournaments, the highs and the lows of medieval jousting and tournaments. So some interesting accidents that happened on the way. So you can check that out. We have a couple of pieces related to medieval literature as well. James Turner, as his series on Arthurian literature is now stopping with Thomas Mowry. So you can check that out. And Thelma Trujillo has done a piece on which translation of Beowulf you should read. So does some comparisons. And if you're looking to pick up a copy of Beowulf, this is what you might want to consider.
Oh, these are some of my favorite things. Jousting, Arthurian literature, Beowulf. Come on, this is an awesome week for the website.
That's right. We put all the fun stuff at the end of the year. So,
have you had a good holiday? You looking forward to 2021?
I have. Peaceful holiday. Hopefully in 2021, we can get back to seeing medieval sites in person. So that would be nice.
That would be nice. I hope it happens. Well, happy new year to you, Peter. And thanks for the tips.
Thanks.
If you're interested in being a part of my brand new Medieval Masterclass for Creators, the clock is ticking. The Medieval Masterclass for Creators is a 6-week online class featuring a total of 6 experts who walk you through everything from cooking to textiles to blacksmithing. We use video to show you colors, textures, and techniques so you can draw, paint, code, or describe the Middle Ages to your readers with both accuracy and ease. Along with these exclusive videos, you get access to manuscript images, photos of artifacts, a bibliography, a community of fellow creators, and access to me to help you work through plot holes. Class starts January 8th and it's filling up quickly. You can find all the information and sign up at medievalmasterclass.com. Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support this year. Whether you're looking for subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine or the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, our exclusive maps by Tina Ross, or you just love the podcast, there is something just for you on our Patreon page. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, check out patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from festivals to fun and foolishness, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and may 2021 be your best year yet.